Welcome back to another episode of Real Estate Investing Unscripted. I'm your host, Brendan Bennett, and with me today is a former guest and also former co-host of the show, Doug Dvorak. Doug, what's going on?
Hey, Brendan. Happy to be here. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to get into today's episode, and if you wouldn't mind giving us some background on who will be speaking today and what the topics are going to look like.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm pumped to be here with our guest, Kevin Kim. He's a well-known industry expert, especially in the private lending space. And Kevin's a partner at Girossi Law Firm out of California. His expertise, which we at Upright are incredibly grateful for, lies in fund formation, private placements, and other security offerings for private lenders. He's a nationally recognized expert in mortgage fund formation, is a leading instructor for the American Association of Private Lenders Certified Fund Manager courses, and also hosts the podcast Lender Lounge, which is a regular in my personal rotation. Welcome, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate the time. Really excited to be on this show. It's good to be on the other side of the mic. That's good.
Yeah, you do such a great job hosting Lender's Lounge. I hope we can hold the cake here.
So. Oh, I've always wondered about, you know, whether it's actually we actually have listeners. It's a pet project for us that we started because we were bored during COVID.
Well, four seasons in, right? You're just wrapping up your fourth season and.
Yeah. I mean, fascinatingly enough, it's gotten some traction, and we've been able to get continuous interest from different people who want to be on the show. And so we're now gearing up for season five. And frankly, we're looking for new ideas. So if anybody has, you know, we've interviewed a lot of folks and brought them on twice now. And so, you know, we're always thinking about expanding and doing different content ideas. And so one of the things that we might be doing is kind of like what you guys are doing, you know, multiple hosts or guests and do an actual pod where we kind of just talk, right? Not have a straight up interview all the time. So, you know, we're thinking about it. We're tooling right now. And my production team is also our marketing team for the law firm. And they're the best, you know, they're always thinking about new ways to promote the law firm. So,
yeah, it's incredibly exciting for me. I mean, that podcast itself is perspectives that are relevant to what I do on a daily basis. So mm-hmm. I appreciate it. I hope you don't pivot too hard, but I know, and we'll kind of channel this into a little bit more about you, but I know, you know, one of your passions is kind of entrepreneurship and understanding the personal story behind the success, right? And so
Right. Tell
us a little bit about yourself. Who is Kevin Kim? Give a little bit of your background. What motivates you?
Well, I'm definitely not, I'm an aspiring entrepreneur, I guess you can say. I'm not really as entrepreneurial as I like to be, but, you know, I'm a third generation banker, and then I reformed, left banking, and went to law school. So my father was a banker. Well, he's a retired banker, and his father was also a banker in Korea. And so finance, lending, you know, credit have always kind of been a core piece of how our brains work, I guess you can say. And I went to law school and, you know, stuck with the whole kind of idea of corporate law and finance, and that's really where I excelled. And so after bumbling through the recession-driven economy of graduating after in 2009, I found my way to Girossi eventually, right? And now, as an associate at Girossi, I found myself in the corporate and securities division doing debt funds. And back then, Girossi was this tiny little law firm. We were maybe like four attorneys, five attorneys at most. You know, I was part-time. It was really small, and we were not very formalized. About a year or two in, I was lucky enough to be part of kind of the core decision-making process of like, hey, we're doing really well in this sector that's called private lending. Let's really double down in it. And we doubled and tripled down in it. And we'd always been very active, but exclusively doubled down in it. And so we stopped doing all the other things that were distractions, and we really doubled down in it, and it's paid dividends since. You know, our conference participation went through the roof. We brought a marketing team in, and that's where I find a lot of my kind of passion and a lot of my extracurricular focus outside of the actual managing the practice of corporate and securities is our firm's marketing and our firm's events. And that's how we ended up with the podcast, right? So, you know, I was helping with the marketing of the firm, doing a lot of content creation and doing a lot of speaking engagements. Well, COVID happens, we can't really go, can't really speak anymore. So let's take back, let's take the microphone and do it online. So the podcast became a thing. So, you know, that all things toward promotion of the law firm and trying to make the law firm well understood to the marketplace. And it's paid dividends. We pride ourselves on becoming, you know, the nation's largest law firm that's focused exclusively in private lending slash hard money. Yep. We don't do anything else, right? We touch real estate here and there on the security side, but 95% of the book, it's private lenders, brokers in private lending, vendors in private lending. You know, we don't touch consumer. We don't touch, you know, agency. All we do is this, right? And so having that level of focus has doubled, has really paid dividends for the law firm, and we've grown significantly from it. And now we're close to about 100 staff. So we're really, really excited of where we're going to go next and where the industry is going to take us. Because this industry is just full of fun stories. You know, it's always a new thing here, a new product there, a new idea there. It's not like any other industry I've been a part of.
Never boring.
Never boring.
Never boring.
Ever. Yep. Yeah.
Kevin, quick question before we dive in a little bit deeper on some of the background that you gave. Where do you think this specific focus in the private money, hard money space, where did that originate from? Was one of the original founders of the company a former investor? Like, what made you guys really silo to that specific thing?
Yeah. So our founder, Anthony Drossi, founded the firm with the idea of being in private lending. He had worked for a local shop, a local law firm that was doing it here locally in California. And, you know, he's a serial entrepreneur to his detriment. Like, that's, he's just, he's like, you know, oh, you know, he's always doing new things. And this idea was, well, this thing is a national thing, right? It's not just hard money is just not a California thing, right? It's all over the country. And so he really doubled down in his focus. Like, this is what I'm good at. And so when I joined the firm in 14, it was already doing a lot of work in the sector, but we were really kind of narrowly focused, right? We were kind of just doing mostly California guys, a few guys across the country, mostly mortgage funds, some loan doc preparation. We weren't thinking about the industry at large. And so what happened in 15, a year after I had joined, there was a conversation of, well, if we're going to take the market by storm nationally, what are we missing? And you started seeing evolution in the law firm starting that year, right? A national practice when it comes to the loan closings. On the fund side, on the security side, it's always been national because of the fact that it's federal law. It's relatively easy. On the loan doc side, it's not, right? And so closing docs across the country, research and compliance across the country, we added sophistication in capital markets as it became a much more prevalent thing starting in 14, leading into 16. You know, we started to improve our skill set in that sector and then also start marketing like crazy in the space. And so, you know, we started throwing our own events. We started doing a lot of content creation. And then that really culminated in 2020 during COVID, when we really just tried to dominate the airwaves with our content, because we knew everyone was at home. We knew no one was, you know, out and about in the field, and they were all freaking out, right? And they're all like, oh, crap, what do I do, right? What do I do in this situation? What do I do in that situation? And so that's when our content machine just kind of went through the roof, and it's all paid dividends, I feel like. And it's established us as somewhat of an expert and reliable source in the space, and I really give a lot of credit to the initial vision of Anthony saying, hey, you know, let's get this thing national. You know,
you're specialized, but your crowd, right? The people that depend on you are kind of all shapes and sizes, right? So you have two different conferences that one focuses on private lending, the other also focuses on kind of borrowers and connecting them with brokers or originators, right? So you're kind of, you're specialized in a way in terms of being an expert in this space, but you're talking to all audiences.
Yeah,
right?
So I don't believe that it's wise. If you want to be in private lending is an interesting market because it's not like conventional where you've got your originators and you've got your investors. It's not like that, right?
Right.
This space is more dynamic. It looks more like kind of the commercial bridge sector than anything else. If you want to compare apples to apples, right, it looks more like the conventional bridge sector with a flavor of that kind of residential conventional piece to it, because it has the correspondence and all that kind of stuff. And
right.
And because of that, it's more dynamic, right? And so you have a variety of capital sources. You have a variety of origination sources. You have a variety of ways to do things. And so we don't believe in like, okay, we only represent the institutional shops. No, absolutely not. Like, we also represent the hard money, private money investor, right? The solo person who's just placing his money through a broker. And we also represent, you know, the national players of the world, including like you guys, but also, you know, the Wall Street types, the Rocks and the Turex and the, you know, the big shops, right? We don't have constructives. We don't have the need to discriminate because at the end of the day, they all have the same kind of need, right? They have the need to do private lending legally and correctly, right? And so, you know, the reality of the market is so diverse that it doesn't make any sense to differentiate between who you are in the marketplace.
And the dynamism of the industry gives you plenty of opportunities to continue to educate and continue to be that expert in the field.
It's always a new topic, man. Every week, it's like, oh man, have you heard about this issue going on in this state? Like, what's funny is also like, you know, what's really interesting is the downstream effects of what happens at the consumer level, right? Of this whole NAR settlement, all these things, you start to think about how does this have an effect on what we're doing as hard money lenders, right? And so, you know, it's so dynamic. It's not so cut and dry like a lot of industries are.
Let's get into a little bit to private funds, specifically mortgage funds. For a subset of our audience that are investors on our platform, can you provide a brief summary of what these are?
Yeah.
Help educate those investors.
Yeah. A mortgage fund, aka a debt fund, aka a credit fund, aka a mortgage pool. I think that's like one of the more older terms that were used. It's simply an LLC or an LP that owns a pool of loans, and the investors get to acquire ownership interest in that pool of loans via becoming a limited partner in that LP or becoming a member in that LLC. And they have some type of economic plan in which they're going to earn a return on their money. And there's going to be a third party kind of management company or general partner that's running the day-to-day, running the operations, managing the ins and outs of the fund, both for loans going into the portfolio and being managed, but also in incoming capital and exiting capital, right? And so the goal there is to create a means to create consistent returns based off of this impressive asset that we all seem to like, these short-term kind of bridge loans that are in first position, secured by either residential or commercial real estate, and allow the investor to benefit from that type of asset class, but not necessarily have to suffer because of a direct placement, right? So this industry was founded on the idea of direct placement, direct mortgage investment. That was kind of the first iteration of this industry. We call it whole and fractional investing in mortgages. That evolved into kind of debt-based investment tied to the actual underlying loan. The problem with those strategies is that you're tied to your initial asset. You don't have diversification across a pool. And you also don't have the benefit of kind of money working year round, right? You have the risk of, you bear the risk of dry powder, whereas the fund can absorb that risk in a much more meaningful way. So the idea of taking the idea from commercial and from real estate, you know, the idea of taking that fund strategy has become a core tenet in the industry. This is why I think that our industry is much more akin to commercial bridge, commercial short-term, commercial construction, as compared to your conventional market because of this particular component, right? And so the dynamism of capital and also the lack of consistent institutional capital as compared to like your conventional Fannie Freddie deals requires this product, right? And so, you know, we've been on the forefront of forming, you know, we do about 100 of these a year, and all different sizes, right? You know, institutional outfits, small outfits, brand new managers, seasoned guys like you guys, and the reality of it is it's just a means to raise money to fund their loans in a much more consistent manner.
Yeah, that speaks to the heart of what we are we're continuing to transition into, right? And so we talk about that, you know, drag, if you will. I think our loans are typically 12 to 18 months in term, but pay off in 9 months. There's unexpected repayments, right, that investors aren't monitoring their platform every single day to then redeploy that capital to find deals that they're interested in their backyards or in, you know, with a developer that has proven themselves time and time again. So trusting that fund manager to continue to deploy the capital into new loans and minimize that cash drag. And then you also have The benefits of leverage. You have the benefits that amplify that for that diversification that you spoke to. Have the tax advantages. So, you know, talking through some of those things, let's talk kind of fund structures there. I'm kind of interested to hear your perspective on some levers fund managers can pull to make their fund kind of more attractive.
And,
you know, obviously the asset class is, you know, the mandate of the fund and obviously what investments will be directed to be made by the fund. But can you share, you know, different types of fund structures you see, REITs, levered, unlevered funds, hybrid funds, and what are the most common today?
I'm a big fan of yield enhancement and engineering in that regard. I believe that it's a very useful strategy if done correctly. And what used to be, you know, 7 years ago, you couldn't do that, right? It was just purely capital, loans, whatever we make is what we make, right? And there's, because lender finance didn't exist back then. Like there was one bank that did it and they were doing it. And so now, many, many more. And yeah, leverage costs a little bit more right now. Sure, people complain about it all the time, but still, it's cheaper than your average actual note rate, right? And cheaper than your average, your cost of capital to your investor. So that arbitrage is meaningful. To put it in simple English, you borrow the money from the bank at 8 and put it on the street at 12. Okay, well now that delta is better than the delta you have to pay your investors. So that gets a benefit to your investors, right? That's added to the income stream for your investors. And also you get the benefit of minimizing cash drag, right? The downside of our space is that we have to fund draws and we have to fund quickly. And so we need to move quickly. We need to fund loans fast. That doesn't line up necessarily with the flow of capital sometimes. And so you need that line of credit to solve that problem. I think leverage is a very misunderstood product on the investor side for funds, on the LP side. You know, LPs, they only have such limited understanding of how things work. And they hear leverage and they think 2008, right?
Risk.
And it's not, like, these products couldn't be further from that, right? There's only one product out there that's marked to market and it's not really worth pursuing. And for your audience who are trying to understand funds, if you're thinking, if you see a debt fund and it has leverage on it, and you got the one thing you got to ask yourself is, well, what kind of leverage is it, right? Is it a true warehouse line or is it a mark-to-market facility? If you see mark-to-market, you got to run for the hills, in my opinion, because mark-to-market means the banker, the lender, can choose to mark the loan's value at basically its discretion and say, all right, well, now the market's taking a dump. We're going to call the line, right? Super risky for the sponsor, for the borrower, which is you guys. None of these programs are like that, right? And so, and they all have significant limits on how much you can borrow against the asset. So, you know, in my opinion, it's no different than the first position loan on the real estate, right? So it's less risky. And if anything, the bankers are actually very, very sophisticated when it comes to the sector. And so they're not going to let you play any funny business with them. And it's a useful strategy because it increases the volume of origination, and it also increases their return, right? Now, there's some taxable benefit, the downsides to that, but still, at the end of the day, it increases their return. That's one piece of the puzzle, but I think it's pretty commonly accepted in the fund formation world, in our world, that it's something that you should pursue. There are only a very small handful of debt funds that don't pursue it. They have their reasons, and I respect those reasons. But they're, you know, it's not common, right? I don't have an objection to a sponsor telling me we're never going to pursue leverage, but I always tell them, really, I want you to think about it because I really want you to look at what it can do for your business. Other features, loan sales, very popular, you know, feature to add to both liquidity and also to enhance yield, right? Because if you sell loans to the secondary, that produces a yield spread. You can also create liquidity by selling the loans off your books. The comment on the REIT component, I mean, the REITs were popular starting in 17 all the way until now. I think they're a very good idea because of the tax benefits that REITs can extend to the investor, right? The sponsors, they don't really get anything out of it. They're doing it purely for the investor. And the reasoning behind it is to make sure that everybody can get that 20% pass-through if they're taxable, right? That's huge for the taxable investors. And then also for the non-taxable guys, eliminates the UBTI entirely. And that's and massively important. If you add leverage to, you know, non-taxable, it creates UBTI. It eliminates that and that entirely. Very, very powerful tool. But it, you know, REITs are not meant for everybody, right? REITs are, it requires a certain level of sophistication and willingness to bear the legal costs to do it. But it's a very powerful tool. And it's quite misunderstood. Also, it's kind of a product of the 08 recession in mortgage. You know, a lot of people that I know, you know, when they first heard REIT, and when 17 rolled around and REITs were a thing because of the Trump tax bill, everyone kind of went to New Century. I went, oh crap, is this like a New Century? Are we going to be like a New Century situation? And it's nowhere near that. It's nothing like that, because we're no longer having to bear the burden of those types of obligations, and we also don't have mark-to-market facilities. So I encourage investors to do it. If anything, you know, a lot of the investor reps that I talk to and investment advisors that I talk to, it's a must-have. They're not even going to look at you if you don't have one, right? So it's a good thing.
Obviously, keeping an eye on regulation there may, you know, in the next few years impact the marketability of REITs. So having options just to be able to pivot.
Yeah, your audience should know that. Yeah, it's important that the Trump tax bill that authorizes this deduction does sunset at the end of 2025. We don't know where that's going to go, right? It's a kind of a coin flip. So I'm just waiting to see the election this year and see where it ends up. If it goes a certain way, it's kind of a foregone conclusion that it's going to be extended. If it doesn't go a certain way, it's still a coin flip. You know, I think it's worth having, or at least having the ability to pursue. So
unlock your real potential. Dive into passive real estate investing with Upright. Make your first investment at upright.us/podcast, and we'll put $200 in your investment wallet. Whether you're looking for a tax-advantaged managed fund to earn long-term income, or you want to actively manage your investments in individual properties, investment opportunities are available with as little as $1,000 minimum investments. Go to upright.us/podcast to make your first investment. Terms apply. Read full details at upright.us/podcast.
Kevin, as you talk about a lot of these different products out there and the advantages to the sponsor and also the investors that are in these funds, mm-hmm. you mentioned that your firm specifically likes to always keep in touch with what is the real estate developer thinking and how are they impacted by some of this. I know some of the benefits are maybe somewhat obvious, right? Access to capital, speed, things of that nature. But can you shed a little bit more light on when sponsors or originators have different outlets and have different vehicles to raise capital and deploy it, mm-hmm. what kind of benefit can a borrower or an operator on the ground level, what can they expect in return for that type of diversity?
Well, so if you're a borrower in our industry, right? So if you're a fix and flip investor, you're building homes, you rent properties, you know, that kind of stuff. The number one thing you want to ask yourself is, who am I working with on the other side of the transaction, right? And so who's my lender? Obviously, if you're an all cash investor, this is not germane to your business model. And they exist. I have two clients like that. You know, I'm not going to say they should pursue finance. Listen, it's your choice, right? But if you're going to pursue financing, it's a question of which way you want to go, right? And I've always found that most borrowers that I talk to and developers that I meet, they're not too interested in, as we joke around, is getting kicked in the nuts all the time on the underwrite, right? They don't want to so the national shops are not ideal in every circumstance, right? They understand that if they're going for perm financing, they're going to have to deal with that kick in the nuts. It is what it is, right? So DSCR is a whole different product. But on the construction or on the flip, if it's a faster deal that they need to move quickly on, they know that they need to go to the right kind of lender. But the question is this, it's do they have the ability to fund my deals consistently? So they have to have enough capital, right? And so I always ask I always tell the borrower, like, when I talk to borrowers about their financing sources, when I hear that you're using kind of like a local single, you know, an investor guy kind of who does a lot of hard money, you know, it makes me nervous, because if they're growing, that person is not going to be able to fulfill their needs. And also isn't going to have the sophistication to figure out the complexities of the transactions they're trying to pursue, particularly for the guys doing rental construction, which is huge right now. And so you need to have some nimbleness. And I always encourage them, you want to talk to a lender that has an understanding of your local market, so has that retail focus, but also has the capital to back it up. And then third, isn't going to kick you in the nuts on the underwrite for everything, right? And so I'm a big fan of the regional lender. the client that has no objection to staying quote unquote hard money. It's become kind of a four-letter word today. But like, if you talk to borrowers, they don't care, right? They think of it all as hard money. So the infighting we have in our industry about private money, private lending, hard money lending, like the borrower can't give two craps about that, right? So
right.
What do they think of you as? So that's what's important. So that, it ultimately boils down to your abilities and also your flexibility as the lender, and that requires different capital sources too, right? Because if you have a balance sheet, then you can kind of do your own thing on the deals that on the borrower that's really good, really attractive borrower, really attractive deal, but you know he's not going to follow you if you, I don't know, require FICO. Well, maybe you can make a deal happen there because you have balance sheet money and you have discretion, right? And so that's also supremely important. So if to sum up three things, you know, local, regional expertise, right? Sufficient capital, right? Both in sufficient diversified capital. And then third, you know, the ability to be flexible on the underwrite and not jeopardize your own business. Right, that's going to be the three things that'll make you successful when it comes to dealing with the borrowers. I don't think that the borrowers are, you know, they. I don't think borrowers personally care, you know, as long as you can get the deal done for them, right, and you do right by them. And sometimes it's intangible. It's not those three things, and that's where relationship and retail, that part of things come into play, right? Where the iLenders of the world aren't going to make it happen because they're never going to get that depth of relationship, you know. So.
Yeah, you talked through capital and maximizing capital. Obviously, we have the institutional side of the business, but where I'm focused on is bringing this institutional quality product to the retail investor, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, as you kind of think through customizing the terms of the funds that we're working with your firm to help, you know, bring to market and the pros and cons of those terms from the perspective of both fund managers and the investors within the fund, you know, management fees, pref, splits over pref, redemption requests, you know, you'd think through alignment and profitability and you know, in exchange, the balance of marketability, right, of the funds themselves.
Yeah.
What are the most kind of common terms and what should an investor consider when deciding whether or not to invest in a mortgage fund?
Well, so there's kind of two big camps when it comes to structure, right? And then I always try to ask the client when we're trying to figure out what they want to do in their fund, right? If the target investor group is going to be more high net worth investor, direct investment into your fund where you're going to find them yourself, right? Versus you're going to be pursuing like, you know, larger family offices, kind of quasi-institutional investors, right? Like endowments and then RIAs. It's kind of two different strategies there, right? And so on the latter, it's much more investor friendly. And by virtue of just their, you know, they can stroke bigger checks, they can carry more weight, right? And the demands there are higher. And the alignment is typically weighted toward the investor, meaning that, you know, there are significant limitations on discretion, significant limitations on leverage, on credit criteria establishment, fee income allocations, all these different things where it's more aligned to the investor. When it comes to the average debt fund that's pursuing just the high net worth investor, the accredited investor, and pursuing it that way, it's typically more balanced. And the rationale behind that is because the cost to operate a business that is constantly raising money, $100,000 at a time, right? That's not easy. It's not an easy thing to do. It's a very challenging machine to build and to maintain. And so the costs are a little bit higher. And so we want the client to understand that. So we typically have a much more balanced approach when it comes to fee allocation. This is one of the areas that gets really contested, right? You know, origination fees and loan-related fee income and asset management fees, we typically don't recommend that they be too low or too high. It kind of have to be balanced enough to make sure that you can sustain the business. Yeah, the first year might be a little bit, it might sting a little bit, but, you know, you can sustain the business. Besides that, on the prefs are a product of your weighted average coupon. Unlevered, right? We want the number to be tolerable to the sponsor that they can hit it every time, marketable enough for the investor to find it attractive, but also, like, you know, it's not a number that you're stressed out about. And so if you're in markets like California or Texas where rate compression is severe, that number might actually be a hindrance to you and you might get rid of it. right? And you might use a different structure, right? So instead of a, you know, a pref and a carry with an asset management fee, you might do just a carry and an asset management fee or something like that, right? Because that stress point, the numbers, you know, California has went, you know, has gone from, you know, 12% to 8% back to 10%. It's kind of all over the place. And Texas is kind of the same boat. And so these bigger markets, you can't swing that as well. If you're more diversified across different states like you guys are, you can swing it, right? And so you, that's a projection of your weighted average coupon in the portfolio that's going to go into this thing, right? Asset management fees, we tend not to, I mean, kind of the top number we don't want things to go over is 2 on equity. We typically don't advise clients charge on like, charge too much on that kind of stuff. I think investors are smart nowadays where, you know, 5-6 years ago, it used to be we'll charge a servicing fee and an asset management fee. That's not so much anymore, right? I think investors are understanding that, hey, you know, servicing and asset management are kind of similar, right? And you're also going to have a third-party servicer probably or a servicing business that has to have expenses. And we don't mind paying the expenses on that, but we don't want to be fed to death. So that's the issue, right? And that this is evolving over the years as the margins continue to shrink. And that cup, you have to understand that, you know, unlevered, the margins are going to shrink. So during the first two, three years of the fund's life cycle, we have to bear that burden until we can add on a credit facility so that the margins can kind of flex a little bit. So, you know, especially in the first year, it's going to be kind of, it's going to be tough. And I always tell clients who are raising their first fund is that first year, that first $5 million of capital coming into your fund is kind of the hardest to raise because you're telling a story that's hard. It's someone's really got to believe in you, right? And so that first $5 million is going to be the toughest $5 million, and then it kind of snowballs and it makes the job a lot easier because your story is no longer just an unproven theory, right? So, and that goes to the last point in structuring. I always tell clients this: like, structure is not the end all be all. I have clients that are close to $500 million under management that have the most unconventional structures. You know, they have the REIT, they have the leverage, they have the loan sales, but the fund's waterfall, it's remarkably different than what you've seen out there, you know? And so there's no hard and fast way to do it. And I'm not a firm believer in you have to do it this way to be successful.
Well, I'll just add, yeah, I mean, not to plug ourselves here, but you're helping us stand up the Blueprint Fund, right? Mm-hmm. This is going to be our launch of a fund focused solely on new construction. And you talk about, you know, trying to sell the problem that you're bringing a solution to market for. It's helpful when we've been in this market for, you know, 8 years, right? And we're just diverting flow that we've typically taken to an institution and bringing it to a retail customer. So, but obviously having the backing of your firm is going to, again, similar to the Horizon Fund that was launched actually a year ago, exactly, being able to leverage your firm and bring something to market at a 1% management fee with an 9% pref for the Blueprint Fund, a little bit higher due to the, you know, higher cost of capital for a ground up construction loan. We're incredibly excited about it and just months away. So thank you real quick live here. Thank you for your help here.
Happy to help. Yeah. And you're in a different position than like your brand new, like the guy that's never raised a dime in his life and is doing his first fund. It's a real big challenge to get off the ground. It's so hard. And you guys have the luxury of like you've got your story and you've been able to prove your thesis to the marketplace in multiple different verticals of capital raising. You know, I always tell folks, like, you know, guys who ask me about, you know, which way should I go? Which way should I offer? Should I offer debt? Should I offer equity? I always tell them, like, look at the Upright program. There's nothing wrong with that. But you also, in the long term, may also want to think about equity. So there's both ways to skin that cat.
Yep. Let's get into RTL, residential transition lending, right? It's a niche asset class. It's pushing towards the mainstream, right? This is shown through the evolution of the securitization market, picking up steam again, rated securitization market that's just getting started in RTL. Why do you think this is happening? How do you think this will change the industry?
So to comment on, you know, the idea that this is becoming popular. This has been the darling of the mortgage buyer's market for the longest time. Yeah. And you think about it, reason why high net worth investors like it, it's a very easy pill to swallow, right? Short-term debt, first position, less than 80% LTV on average, and it's at the institutional level, fully underwritten, right? And you're also able to, bring on institutional grade servicers that are rated. It's great because, you know, comparatively, look at the conventional market. I got a whole 30-year paper. You know, it's so much a better pill to swallow.
Yep.
So take that, and now, okay, we figured out that we like this product. The institution, they figured out we like this product. It's a great product for us. We want to double down on it. Well, the problem has always been that it's, you know, the way to actually raise money in this sector at the institutional level has been, you know, securitization, LifeCo kind of been the paths. And right now it's very LifeCo because of the way of the cost of capital. But, you know, I think we're recording this, it's April, but, you know, recently this past month, the first rate of securitization in RTL happened. And there's very exciting times. But the reality of it is that it's just a way to get this thing to be more eligible to invest in, right?
Right.
This was going to happen. It wasn't a question of if; it was a question of when, right? And kudos to the folks that have, you know, done the first one. It's going to be painful for the first few rounds because people are kind of bumbling through, right? But the idea of a rated securitization is nothing more than just a revolving line of credit, right? That's filled with loans, and that revolving line of credit is quote unquote institutional grade, meaning that it's been built out to be attractive to the Wall Street investor, and then now it's been rated by the whatever rating agency, I think it's Morningstar, to now be eligible as investment grade to the various different fixed income investors, pension plans and whatever you have it, right? So now it's becoming more attractive. Now it's eligible to be invested in by the broader audiences that are fixed income investors. Now, the problem with this is that it's still too early to say whether this is going to make a meaningful change. You know, I had a meeting with a client of mine who's a big private lender across the country. They're in San Francisco, and he had kind of had a negative view on this, saying that, like, this might result in too much capital, right? Because you got to think the fixed income market that's investing in the private label securitizations are this, and then now that you got to rate it, it's going to be like, you know. So
yep.
Who knows? But then, you know, upon having meetings with different principals who work in these sectors and interviews too, they've all viewed like you can have as much capital as you want. It doesn't make a difference because there's only a certain amount of inventory. So right. We can only do so much volume. So maybe it might drive price down a little bit, but that's as far as it's going to go. So, you know, it's a hard thing to predict. The only thing I know for sure that this is going to become pursued pretty consistently by the institutional investors in our sector, because it opens the gate, it opens the eligible investor pool, right? And
yep.
What it'll likely do on the folks that are doing their own securitizations, their actual originators that are doing their own private label, their own rated securitization, is going to be the underwriting criteria is going to be much more stringent. So that's going to be the big one, right? The depth of the qualifications to be rated, both in the portfolio of loans, but also in the originator, it's a much more difficult qualification process. But once that's become kind of commoditized, I don't foresee it to be very onerous. But it's going to be the first year, I think the first 2 years of this, it's going to be very painful on the originator side. And that's not to say the guys who originate and sell to the aggregate. I'm talking about the guys who are doing their own securitization, right? So if Upright were to pursue a securitization on their own that was rated, right, the load that would have been inserted onto your business, right, from an operational underwriting perspective by the banker that's going to run the securitization is going to be higher because you want to get rated. And the vendors that you have to use is going to be much more narrow selection because it has to be rated. So that's kind of the pain points that will come from this. But who knows? I don't. It's hard to tell right now. But I do think it's a benefit to the industry. I think it gives a lot more credit to the space. I think the LifeCos are going to be kind of upset because this has been a great place for them for the past 3 years. I think that once this becomes kind of standardized, it'll be bad for them. Just considering that, you know, cost of capital is going to go down, but they'll figure it out. It's just we're kind of at the infancy stage about it, right? And it's going to be one of those. They're building the muscles right now, and You know, a lot of folks joke about, you know, first one through the door gets shot, right? I don't view it that way. I think it's more like, okay, you guys have been willing to be the sacrificial lamb to figure this out and trudge your way through it, but it's not like you're going to die from it, right? It's just trudge your way through it and figure it out, and people will follow suit and learn lessons from what you have gone through. And hopefully you'll share those lessons learned too, because your banker will probably will, right? So, you know, that's where I think we're headed with this. And I recently interviewed Beth O'Brien, who has a lot of experience with this, and she was saying that it's not a bad thing, it's a good thing, but it's gonna be drudgery for the first few years, just because we just don't know how it's, you know, all the different things that we need, all the boxes that we need to check, all the pieces that we need to do it. And, you know, a new rating agency comes in, you're going to get new standards and practices. And that's the reality of it, you know?
So a question maybe to both of you guys on this conversation, as more of these rated securitizations get done and a lot more institutional money is introduced into the space, do you guys think that adds a benefit or maybe a drawback for that individual who's an accredited investor still looking to make individual investment decisions? Maybe they don't want to, you know, invest through some sort of wide market. They want to kind of have the ability to choose a fund or choose even a specific project, debt or equity. Mm-hmm. Does this increase access or decrease access for that accredited investor?
If we're following trend, I mean, the ability to direct invest. So what I call direct invest is either a direct investment into the loan. We call that trusted investing out here in California, right? Whole or fractional, right? Mm-hmm. Or some type of like direct note-based investment. I think that'll go away eventually. I think it'll slowly, you know, the note-based investment, not so much. It's still kind of similar to a fund. But the whole and fractional, it's already been kind of slowly dying. Because if you do a whole and fractional arrangement for an investor, you as the lender, you as the originator, don't get the benefit of being able to sell that loan, to lever that loan. And in today's marketplace, you need those abilities. And so I think that that's going to go away slowly but surely. It will always be a local niche thing, right? You guys may not know them, but like there's a shop out here in Newport Beach that's been doing this for 30 years, and they're very popular. Right? Everyone knows them out here. You know, their product, it's gone in less than 30 seconds, and they're never going to go away. That's never going to go away for them, right? But market writ large, I don't think it's going to stick around for a long time. These solutions lead us down the path of, you know, direct balance sheet lending. Now, what's been posited is like, oh, are we going to end up like conventional and non-QM where everyone's just going to rely on repo lines and sale agreements? And I don't think that's going to be the case, because this market, like I said before, it's very similar to commercial. And so you're always going to have kind of two parts of the industry. You're going to have the quote-unquote institutional-grade loans that are that fit the kind of securitization guidelines and boxes. And then you have the other sector that's more creative, right? And for as long as rates are high, that sector is going to thrive, you know? And that requires balance sheet discretionary capital. You can't put, you know, your creatively structured construction loan into a securitization. It's just not going to work. So, you know, that's where we still have a need. And you got to love our industry for having the creativity that it has, right? I mean, all kinds of products are out there.
Yeah, I would add it in the short term anyways, adds credibility to the space, right? So the fact that it's even being considered to go this route is an endorsement for the space, for people that are a little bit less, you know, aware of it and stumble upon Upright.us and, you know, like what they see from a return perspective and see that it's in their backyard and that it's tangible. It does add that credibility. I think part of it is, you know, being able to partner up with a firm that they trust, that they understand, you know, has continued to, you know, prove themselves right over time is going to only give them more confidence to continue investing with that partner, right? But yeah, we'll see where ground up construction goes, even from a rated securitization space, and how you know, soon that'll ultimately happen. But
it'll get securitized. It always, there's a way to do it. I mean, ATCs have been securitized, you know, shout out to Ryan Kraft over at Saluda. He did it, you know, and they're not rated, but there's ways to figure it out eventually whether the rating will be high or not. I mean, this past one, the rating was higher than I expected it to be, but, you know, it'll find a way if they really want to pursue it. But construction is a weird product, right? Construction, you know, a lot of folks have different ways to do them, and I don't know how you standardize construction. I really don't.
Yep.
You know, so if they can standardize it, then maybe. So you know,
there's always going to be those borrowers, and Brendan, you could speak to this too, of, you know, they're not as concerned with the cost of capital if it's going to make them jump through 1,000 hoops to get there or take this much longer to get the financing done, right? This is a speed game. This is a partner game. This is somebody that understands the space, and ultimately we're an asset-based lender at the end of the day. So, you know.
Yeah, and Kevin, you talk about no matter the supply of capital in the space, inventory is relatively fixed, which I do think is true, but I also think there's a point where if the influx of capital brings the rates down to where they're only a point or two away from conventional lending, a lot of those new construction builders that go to a conventional bank will say, hey, the process is a little bit easier. I'm going to switch over. Okay. And now we have an increase of inventory in the space, which I think is, you know, what we're really excited about, right? To attract the best operators, you have to have a process that makes intuitive sense to leave a conventional banking relationship or commercial banking relationship to come with a lender similar to us. So I think that's the exciting thing for us on the origination side.
That was the argument that Bill Tesser was making when I interviewed him. He was saying that the opportunity that we're seeing right now is a fraction of what actually exists out there because you're discounting the conventional market. And when you look in conventional markets, not just the conventional, like, you know, the Fannie Freddie agency and that kind of stuff. It's also the bank lending. And you're discounting the fact that there's so much opportunity and volume there. I don't disagree with that. I think that's a very valid point. My point is that there's only so much real estate that can be built in the country.
Sure.
And there's markets where it's easier to build than others, right? And those markets will continue to grow. But like in markets like mine in California, you can't build anything out here, right? So it's a weird balancing act. I think we're gonna see a shift in concentration into different markets. Just like, you know, 7 years ago in California, no one would go near Texas. Now everyone lends in Texas. And I think that's going to shift, right? And we're going to start seeing an attention being driven toward other pockets of the country where inventory actually exists.
I was going to bring out the crystal ball here to wrap us up. You know, what trends do you see in the resi market? Any predictions on where, from a macro perspective, things head through 2024 into 2025? I know.
Yeah.
You shared you may be looking for a home yourself. I know you shared the NAR settlement.
I am in a very weird place on that. You know, it's April, so I'm actually a home buyer, right? I'm trying to buy a house, right? Because I have two little girls, and we've outgrown our current house and need to buy another one, right? And so it's a weird time because I'm seeing on that side of things too, and it's refreshing. I'm actually thinking that next year is probably going to be better than this year. So we're still in early 2024.
Yeah.
You know, this year is probably going to be more of the same. I don't expect there to be much. There'll probably be some excitement come summer just because, you know, the first rate cuts will probably happen. But we all know they're not going to be as dramatic as we expect them to be. They never are. And so there'll probably be some excitement that comes from it. They'll, you know, it'll move some volume off the sidelines. But, you know, the funny part also that on the flip side of things is that we're not seeing this massive, you know, run for the hills. It's the market is still doing decently well, comparatively speaking, right? And the rates are still moderately attractive if you're a seasoned investor, right? And so I don't necessarily view like 2024 as like, oh my God, the world is ending. June of last year, everyone was like, oh my God. We were like, what? No, hold on. Like, just the market's going to take a little bit of a dip and it's going to shift a little bit and strategies are going to change. But like, it's not that, you know, it's not the end of the world. And that's kind of what we're seeing right now is it's people are waking up and figuring out, okay, let's figure this out. Let's get this done. And they're also positive about future results because there will be a change in the rates. It's going to happen. The prices are going to have to come down eventually on the cost of capital. Beyond that, next year is probably going to be better than this year. And the year after that's probably going to be better after that. I think it's just going to continue to get better. Not in like, you know, for private lending at least, all this volume like we did in 2021. I don't think it's going to be 2021 over again. But I do think that activity will continue to increase. I still think volume is in a place where there's still some room. You're going to see an increase in kind of construction. It's a logical expansion of what we're trying to do. There's only so much RTL you can do, right? I mean, fix and flip you can do. The real actual big question for me is where DSCR is going to be headed. Don't really know where that's going to end up because it's a strange product. It's not really well understood, but I don't think we don't exactly know whether certain markets will start phasing out. Like, there are certain markets you can't do DSCR in, like, whether that phenomenon will extend to other markets where it's very popular in, right? We don't know whether that's going to happen or not. But DSCR is kind of the big question mark for me. For the rest of the products, fix and flip construction, I think it's going to increase in volume. I think all the borrowers that have been waiting, they'll get off. And the buyers too, right? People like me are buying right now. That's fine. Give it a year or so. When the rates come down a little bit, they'll come off the sidelines for sure. And people are so worried about like, oh, we're going to see a huge dip in pricing and values. I don't see that coming. I don't see it. It's not there right now. Would it be there later?
Not with the supply constraints. So. Hopefully we can meet, you know, the 3 or 4X buyers that are Kevin Kim a year from now with some supplies.
Well, that's my logic, right? Like, I want to be in before I have to pay 3X, 4X because it's going to happen, right? Once the rates come down, all those buyers are coming off the sidelines. It's just common in,
of course.
You know, supply and demand economics, right? So.
Well, Kevin, we really appreciate having you on today. A lot of additional insight to the listeners on a lot of the stuff that Doug works on day-to-day basis, but the things that ultimately impact both investors and borrowers in our fund. So if people have questions or want to learn a little bit more about you and the content you provide, where should they find you?
Well, you can go on our website, gerasilawfirm.com. Pretty straightforward. You can also go, we have a YouTube page for Lender Lounge. So, you know, we're on all the different platforms, Apple, Spotify, YouTube. So check out the podcast on there. And then if you want to learn more about the law firm and the content we create for the law firm, you can also go to, our website's the best place. So gerasilawfirm.com is it. It's GERACI lawfirm.com. Pretty easy to find us. And you can find my content on there, my contact on there, you know, the rest of the partners. And we're happy to, you know, consult and talk with anybody. So, you know, happy to learn more about what your listeners are doing and, you know, hope we can help them out.
You've been great, Kevin. Thanks for talking as always.
Oh, appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks again for tuning into this week's show. Make sure to let us know what you think or write in with suggestions, guests, or topics at podcast@upright.us. And if you like the show, click that like and subscribe button and give us a 5-star rating wherever you are listening. And check out our other episodes of Real Estate Investing Unscripted on all of your favorite podcast platforms. We'll see you guys next time.